So I was hoping this morning to make a contribution. This is my idea, to make a contribution from a Buddhist perspective, both to our personal psychology, always important, as well as to our national psychology, our national life. And I thought, boy, that's pretty arrogant to think I could do such a thing. And perhaps it is. But I do feel that certain insights and understandings that come from Buddhism are so well articulated and so accurate. They're really helpful for us. And in some way, the Buddhist perspective, I think, is very simple. Just see things as they are. Suzuki Roshi used to say in his incorrect English, you never knew whether what he was saying was deep and profound or just he didn't know how to speak English so well. You know, it was always a mystery about that. He used to say, to see things as it is. To see things as it is. To see the universe as it is, and to see things as they are. Fully as they are. In a very complete way. A very round way. A very open and flexible way. You could say that's, a 20-word summary of Buddhist practice and the Buddhist perspective. To see things as they are, and then to live according to that vision. To live an open life according to that wide and flexible way of seeing things. So I think it's pretty simple, so let's all go home now. Simple, what do they say? It's simple but not easy, you know? Somebody cut out a cartoon from the most recent New Yorker and gave it to me a few days ago. Maybe you saw it. The cartoonist is the person who signs B-E-K. If you're a New Yorker fan, you know who I mean. So the cartoon is two women sitting and talking, and clearly one of them is explaining something to the other. In fact, her hands are kind of like this. And they both have very straight faces, no expression on their faces. And the caption is, it's easy. The first step is to entirely change who you are. I thought that was very Zen, very, very Zen. It's very easy, just change who you are completely and then everything will work out from there. And Suzuki Roshi also appreciated the difficulty and helped define the difficulty of practice, of bringing a Buddhist perspective into our daily life. Right at the beginning of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, you know, many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the teachings of Suzuki Roshi that are in that book. The very first essay, which is Beginner's Mind essay, the very first words of that essay are, people say that practicing Zen is difficult, but there is a misunderstanding as to why. It is not difficult because it is hard to sit in the cross-legged position or to attain enlightenment. It is difficult because it is hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. That was the very beginning, the very opening of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I enjoy the way he says, it's not difficult because it is hard to sit in the cross-legged posture or to attain enlightenment. Oh, is that so? That's the not difficult part, huh? I see. Well, that's the not difficult part. I thought that was the difficult part. No, that's not difficult. What's difficult is to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. So I think partly he meant it's not so difficult to be fancy schmancy, you know, Zen-ness and, you know, emptiness and shunyata and elevated and esoteric and ethereal. That's not so hard. But to actually inject our life with practice, to actually have our life express our practice, is the hard part. In each moment, not only in each moment, but difficult moments, particularly in difficult moments. It's difficult, he says, because it's hard to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense. And I think when he says in its fundamental sense, that's a little bit of a tip-off for us. Because when he says pure, he doesn't mean pure, I don't think. My own sense of it is that he doesn't mean pure in the usual way we think of pure. The usual way we think of it, pure means like rarefied, like separating things out. I thought of Hamlet, you know, where Hamlet says, oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt and resolve itself into a dew. That's our usual idea of purity, that the sullied part should melt away, go away. We should get beyond the sullied part, and then it resolves itself into a dew, and then we're left with pure enlightenment, so to speak. That's the usual idea of purity, but I don't think that's what he meant at all. Why it's difficult to keep our mind pure and our practice pure in its fundamental sense is because the purity that Suzuki Roshi is talking about is a purity that is very wide. It's not get rid of the sullied part. It's not unsullied in that sense. In the midst of sully is purity, I think is what Suzuki Roshi is meaning there. Right in the middle of it. Not separated from it. So to have a pure mind in its fundamental sense, I think, means to have an open, wide, flexible, stable mind, relaxed and attentive mind, just like an instruction for meditation. We say have a relaxed and attentive attitude, which is a contradiction, of course, because relax goes one way and attention goes the other. So, to have an attitude that's relaxed, not tense, but attentive. And attentive, but not too holding on to something too tight. Relaxed. This is called being awake to the moment. So I think this is one way of speaking about an aspect of the Buddhist view of things, and I want to speak more about our view, our understanding. A view, as some of you may know from the teaching, is very, very essential. How we see things, how we understand things, is the first step, really. In the first sermon of Shakyamuni Buddha's, where he elucidates the Four Noble Truths, he also speaks of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the way to bring practice into, bring a practice understanding, bring an awake understanding into our life. I would say Buddhist understanding, but you know the word Buddha, Buddhism, the root is B-U-D-D. It's a Sanskrit root, Bud. It means awake or wake up. So actually we call this, whatever you want to call it, practice, religion, way of life, we call it by its Sanskrit name. We call it Buddhism. If we wanted to speak in English, we would say awakeism. Wake-up-ism is the name of our practice. Wake up. So how to lead an awake life, or how to work, it sounds too, sounds like somebody's leading an awake life. Everyone is asleep, but we work on it. We work on being awake. And the way we work on it, first of all, is through how we see things, what our view is. This is the first of the Eightfold Path, the first of the eight steps of practice. Then, based on view, based on how we see things, comes intention. Very organic, very, straightforward understanding. If you think about it, it makes a great deal of sense. How you understand something, and then next, built on how you understand something, is intention. And then from intention comes everything else, speech and action and livelihood and meditation and so on. So it's very important in whatever style of practice we do to work on and develop and cultivate our view, how we see things. So as a method of doing that, as a means of doing that, I want to talk about a movie that was playing about a year ago, The Truman Show. How many of you saw The Truman Show? Oh, good. I did not see it. But I'm going to talk about it anyway. So, in psychotherapeutic lingo, you'd have to say, I'm going to talk about my fantasy of what the Truman Show movie is about. This is my imagination of it. My imagination, pretty good. It's pretty good. It was a pretty good movie in my imagination. I don't know how the movie, actually was, but my imagination of it was pretty. I liked it. So the Truman Show, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, just briefly, is about. It's an. I believe my. Again, my. I'll just speak about my fantasy of it. It's an allegory. It's an allegory about living the true life. Even the main character's name, Jim Carrey, Truman. He's a true man, true person. And but his life is completely false, because the premise of the movie is that he's actually, from the time he was born, this was a detail I didn't get, from the time he was born or from some time, everyone around him are actors and actresses. And he's living in a completely false world, and he is filmed from hundreds of cameras, hidden cameras all over the place, and then people take great delight in tuning in to the Truman Show and watching this true man in the midst. He thinks, he doesn't know that he's surrounded by actors, he thinks he's leading a true life. But he's not. He's leading a, well, is he or isn't he? He's leading a true life in the midst of a totally false world. That's the allegory. Do you get it? Do you understand? Then, at the end of the movie, toward the end of the movie, he's sailing in a boat. And he thinks he's on a lake or a bay or someplace. But actually, he's just on a giant set, right? Because he's in a false world. So he's sailing along, and he sails further than he usually goes. And he sails, and then after a while, his boat hits the sky. Because the sky is not the real sky. The sky is just the back wall of the set. So his boat hits the sky, and he comes to the end of his world. He comes to the end of the false world. Then there, excuse me. Then he looks up, and up in the sky is a stairway going up into the sky, which is the back wall of the set, and a door, and above the door is the word exit. You get it? It's kind of neat, huh? Just like our life, right? Sooner or later, we hit the sky. And then we see that there's an exit door. And then, like Truman, he had to then decide, again, I don't know exactly, but I believe that what happened then is that he had then to decide whether he was going to go through the exit door into a completely unknown world, a completely mysterious and unknown wide open world, or stay in the comfort of his false world. Comfortable. He was very secure. He knew what was what. He knew what was up and what was down in this world that he had developed in, but he didn't know what was outside the door. So a couple of points. One is, there is always an exit door in our life. Sometimes it's more obvious, sometimes it's less obvious, but always there is this possibility of exiting from our false life, our constrained life, our partial life, to a wide open place, to an open place, but we don't know what it is exactly. It's an unknown. So what I'm emphasizing is the immediacy of it. Suzuki Roshi often would say things like, this is not a quote, but he would say things like, right in the middle of your muddled and confused life, find your path there. Not, again, it's like this thing about sullied. Not get rid of the sullied part, not get rid of the confusion, not wait. He was encouraging us, don't wait till everything is all clear, which is a very different understanding than our usual understanding, even our understanding approaching practice. Because I thought, oh, I'll start to practice Zen, then the confusion and the muddled part will go away, everything will become clear and unmuddled, and then I will be on the path, and then everything will be okay. Then I'll just sail along from there, right? I'll just coast along from there. But that's not what he used to say. He used to say, right in the middle of our confused and muddled life, there we should find a path. This is the same thing as Dogen, who is a Zen ancestor. a Japanese Zen teacher who lived in the 13th century. This is the same thing that Dogen says in a work of his called the Fukan Zazengi. Fukan Zazengi is instructions about how to practice Zazen, how to practice Zen, how to practice sitting meditation. And they're unusual instructions, because there's kind of very mundane sorts of instructions. Some of you may know the work. You know, like put your left foot on your right thigh and your right foot on your left thigh and put your hands this way and put your shoulders this way and so on and so forth. And then in all mixed in with that is Dogen's kind of, he's a very far out kind of a guy, you know. That's what we would have said 30 years ago. I don't know what kids say today, but he's very far out, you know. He'd say all sorts of very unusual, poetic kinds of things that he would say. For example, in the Fukan Zazengi, he says, why go off to the dusty realms of other lands and leave the seat that exists in your own home? Do you see how that's the same thing as right in the middle of our muddled and confused life, we should find our path? Don't go off to the dusty realms of other lands. Don't leave. Don't go someplace else. Don't think there is a someplace else to go. But right in the middle of it, we find our home. We find our seat in our own home. And then earlier in Fukan Zazengi, he says, if you want to attain suchness, practice suchness without delay. This is the same thing. We don't have to wait. There's no necessity for postponing anything. Right now is suchness. Right now we can open the door that says exit over it in the midst of our life. So that's the first point. And the second point is, as you well may ask, what is this suchness business? You know, what is suchness? Where'd you get a word like suchness? what kind of a word is suchness? It's such a... who knows what they're talking about, suchness, you know? Do you ever get that feeling? It must be for advanced meditators, this realm of suchness. Only very advanced people know about it, so ordinary Joe like me, ordinary Jane like me, I forget it. Forget suchness. But again, my own sense is that really what suchness means, or we could say the operational definition of the word suchness. I'll explain what I mean by operational definition. When I went to school to study psychotherapy, one of the courses that I took was called Research Methodology. I guess I found almost totally irrelevant to my development as a psychotherapist. But there's one thing that I remember from research methodology, which is operational definition. An operational definition is when you can't see something, it's a way of defining it, even though you can't see it. What I mean is, the usual example is that if you can't measure anxiety in a mouse in an experiment, you know. there's no measurement for it, but the operation, you can operationally define anxiety. So if the mouse runs back and forth in the cage 50 times instead of running back and forth in the cage 10 times as a normal mouse would, you could say that mouse is 5 times as anxious as a normal mouse. You get it? See what I mean? So I think that I believe, I understand that the operational definition of suchness is this very same open and flexible mind. A mind that's available, a ready mind. Again, Suzuki Roshi said, it is the readiness of mind that is wisdom. Not some particular thing. There's not some particular thing called wisdom. It's being ready. It's being ready to see the exit door and being ready to go out the exit door at any moment of our life. So, as I am sure you are doing, I've been talking with since September 11th with friends and family and everyone, and thinking about, feeling about what to do and how to respond and how to understand our life and so on. I was speaking with a friend of mine a few days ago, last week, a week ago today. Excuse me. And he said to me, we were talking about September 11th, and he said to me, he said, for me, it's a wake-up call. And I thought, that's very good. That's pretty good. It's a wake-up call. It's like hitting the back wall, hitting the sky of our false life, and then seeing that there's something else going on that we have to take into account, not just what's in our small world. What I thought when he said that, actually the thought that I had, which I said back to him right away, is that when there's a wake-up call, when the alarm rings, there's essentially two choices. One choice is that we wake up. We listen to the alarm, we heed the alarm, and we wake up. The other choice is we hit the snooze button. And go back to sleep. And then it rings again and we hit the snooze button again and go back to sleep. And then it rings again and then we pick up the alarm clock and we throw it with all of our might at the wall, hoping that it will break and be quiet and let us go to sleep and let us stay asleep, because we like sleep. It's very comfortable. It's very soothing to be asleep. this is the way we are. We're not interested in waking up. Thank you very much. I think so anyway. Maybe you're different, but for me anyway, for most of us, for most people who I talk to, especially the ones who say they're interested in waking up, those are the ones who really like to sleep, you know? They like to sleep in the sleep called, I like waking up. That's sleep. They like that state of sleep very much, you know? So I think we have to cultivate, we have to encourage, we have to bring forth and cultivate like we cultivate a plant, you know, water it, weed it. We have to cultivate this willingness to wake up when the alarm rings, when there's a wake-up call. And this is the same thing that Jim Carrey faced when he was at the end of the world and saw the exit door. That juncture is always there. Are we going to stay in our comfortable world, in our secure world, or are we willing to take a chance on a big, mysterious, frightening world, open world? And I don't think it's a small question. What I mean is, I don't think this desire that we have for comfort and for sleep is some silly little thing. This is very true, very real for us. Our desire to be secure and our fear of being insecure. Our fear of what's not known. Very powerful. So from a Buddhist perspective, a Buddhist view, I believe, the Buddhist view is the one that encourages the widest kind of stability. Not a security based on a partial view, but very, very wide. So I thought of the Diamond Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra, it says, therefore then, Subhuti, a bodhisattva, a great being, should produce a thought that is unsupported by forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects, unsupported by dharma, unsupported by no dharma. And why? Because all supports have actually no support. This is, you can't get any wider than that, you know? So this is finding support where there is no support. This is finding our bearings where there are no bearings. And guess where there are no bearings? Right here, right now, right in our life. We can create the illusion that we have our bearings. But I'm afraid that mostly this is like Truman's false world. Sooner or later, we hit that back wall. Oh, I've got a pain over here. That's hitting the back wall. September 11th, that's hitting the back wall. Fighting with your wife or your husband or your girlfriend or boyfriend or son or daughter or brother or sister, that's hitting the back wall. Sooner or later, we hit the back wall. And that's where Buddhism comes in handy. Because Buddhism is built for when you hit the back wall. It's built on no building. It's built on no support. It's built on the world of not supported by dharma, not supported by no dharma, not supported by anything. So, let's see. I'll say one more thing and then I'll end. So technically, in the psychotherapeutic world, we call this, how does one bind one's anxiety? This is the existential psychotherapeutic question. Because when you see that exit door, you might be able to, for a while, course around in... We might be able for a while to convince ourselves that everything is just peachy, hunky-dory, and there ain't no problems. But when we see the exit door, when we realize, oops, this is not the sky, this is just the back wall, that fills us with dread, fills us with anxiety. Then there are two junctures, at that juncture of anxiety then, there are two ways to go, I would say, in summary. One way is the way of restriction, the way of constriction, and the other is the way of openness, the way of being wide. So we attempt to bind our anxiety by restricting the situation. Usually, that's our habitual way. And Buddhism encourages us in the other direction. There's this Sanskrit term anupalabdhi dharma kashanti, which means which expresses this. It means the intuitive tolerance for the inconceivability of all things. When we see that exit door in the sky, that's inconceivability. We thought everything was very conceivable. We thought we had it down. We thought we knew what we were talking about, what was right and what was wrong. But when we see the exit door, that's inconceivability. How do we meet inconceivability? You can't meet it with anything conceivable. You can't grab a hold of it. You can't conceptualize it. You can't draw it into the small world. Really, the only thing to do is tolerate it. Doesn't sound like much, you know? Big deal. Tolerate it, you know? Can't we come up with something better than that, you know? We want to control it, right? We want to make sure, you know, we want to be able to turn the key and then the car starts. But this particular car is inconceivable. We turn the key and who knows what happens. The intuitive tolerance, kshanti, for those of you familiar with the paramitas, kshanti is patience, the third paramita. The intuitive tolerance for the inconceivability of all things. So to contrast it one more time, one way to bind our anxiety and to try to secure something in an unsecurable world is to convince ourselves that we know who's right and who's wrong. That we know who's good and who's bad. Who's going to go to heaven and who's going to go to hell? If we can convince ourselves that we know exactly what the rules are and exactly, you know, who fits into what category, this temporarily seems to provide some stability, some security, some secure way of understanding things. So I'll contrast with that way what I'm indicating, what I'm promoting, or not promoting, but speaking about as the as a Buddhist understanding, by quoting a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. You familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh? Zen Vipassana Vietnamese monk who pretty well known. And maybe some of you then would know his poem, "Please Call Me By My True Names." Yeah, I see some of you do. This poem is an expression of an extremely wide understanding, of a very deep, full, open way of understanding things. I'll quote just a little bit of it. The beginning is, "Don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today, I am still arriving." And then he goes on to say various, to identify himself with various things. "I am the mayfly. I'm the bird that swoops down and eats the mayfly. I am like a frog in the spring swimming along in a pond. I am also the snake that eats the frog." And then these verses come. "I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones. My legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda." "I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee in a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the sea pirate whose heart is not yet capable of seeing and loving. Please call me by my true names so I can wake up. And the door of my heart could be left open. The door of compassion." So this is a mind, this is an understanding that's very wide, that doesn't separate out they're bad, I'm good, but sees everything as oneself. They're very courageous. It's a very courageous perspective and difficult for us to get to. And yet, I think this is seeing things as they are, seeing things as it is, not with a partial view in a false life. So that's what I was going to say. Thank you very much. So if there are questions or a little discussion, I'm not sure of what the right, what the appropriate protocol is. Gil wrote me an email. He said, at a certain time, people will start to leave. Don't feel bad. But if you want to talk for a little bit, please, please say something. You don't have to. Not sure if there was a question in that. I thought that was a very good statement.
With the realization that everyone does not have that perspective.
Yes.
I can't say that I do either.
Okay. And me neither. None of us do. Not even Thich Nhat Hanh does. We shouldn't confuse ourselves in that way. There isn't some elevated class of beings who have compassion completely and always, you know. So it's a matter of cultivation. But to answer your question, to attempt to respond to it, I doubt that I'll answer it. It's the issue of what's called skillful means. So Buddhist teaching is wisdom and skillful means. Skillful means how do you translate the wisdom into action, you know. When Buddha spoke to certain people, he spoke, you know, this way. When he spoke to Italians, he spoke Italian. When he spoke to Chinese people, he spoke Chinese. This is skillful means. It's a way of translating the wisdom into action. And I wrote a poem about skillful means that's very brief and silly. Here it is. Wisdom ain't worth a hill of beans unless you've got skillful means. So your question is very important, you know. How do you what are the skillful means? And I don't have an answer. Or I could say, there are a million answers. Or how many people? 5 billion answers. So that's why... I was talking about intention. View, that first step of the Eightfold Path. Then, if you want, we can talk now about how does that translate into skillful means. But we better go get some lunch first, because it's going to be a long discussion. You know? It's going to be a long time. It's endless. Skillful means is endless. How do you do it? The other classic Zen, you know, the Zen master response when somebody asks a good question is they say, that's a good question, now get the hell out of here. So how do we do it? How do we do it? When in fact, like us, others close off their world in terrible ways, in ways that sometimes, you know, mean injury or death of ourselves or even worse, those we love. How do we meet that? Without also closing off. That's the natural response. Or that is a natural response. That's what's so curious about us human beings, what's natural. So I don't think there's any unitary answer to that. But I do know, and I absolutely do know it, or I believe it, I have great conviction that having this perspective is very helpful. So when we confront somebody who on the freeway cuts in front of us, or when we cut in front of them and they indicate their extreme anger by certain physical gestures, you know, what then? That's a good question. What then? What do? Can we see the exit door? Can we even remember that there's an exit door? That's pretty good. Oh, there's this story. I'll tell you this story. It's a very powerful story. It's in Crooked Cucumber, which is a biography of Suzuki Roshi. And it was during the Vietnam War. I'll make it brief. There was a demonstration, a protest going on a day that he was giving a Dharma talk. And he finished his Dharma talk and asked for questions. And someone said, why are we here in this Dharma talk when there's an anti-war demonstration going on? We should be joining them. This is relevant to this kind of thing you were asking. And very uncharacteristically, he was on a platform, you know, like up on that stage there, speaking. He leapt off the platform and he had a staff that sometimes Zen teachers have. And he started hitting this person on the shoulders. It was a student who he knew well and who knew him well. So it wasn't like, random violence. He started hitting him. And he was, dreamers. Like that. He said, dreamers, what are you dreaming of? And then when he calmed down a bit and got back up on his seat, he said something like, how can you think of what to do when you can't even tie your own shoelaces? That's a pretty harsh pretty strong thing to say, but I think we should figure out how to tie our own shoelaces. It's very helpful, very essential, very basic for us to tie our own shoelaces. Tie our own shoelaces means know that there's an exit door. Remember, if in a moment of that we can remember that there's an exit door, that there's the possibility that it's not just they're wrong, I'm right. That's already doing a lot. That's already doing a lot. So some of the people at Green Gulch go to Mill Valley once a week and do a silent vigil. And it's not exactly an anti-war vigil. It's just a silent vigil. And I think I think it's good, you know. I mean, I'm sure it could be better, and I'm sure there are many other things. But to just stand there and shut up. Everybody's got so much to say. There's so much to say about who's right and who's wrong. Especially when you get into who's right and who's wrong. You can argue forever. Just to stand there in the middle of our life and shut up is already a pretty good action. So I'll cease from anything else. Okay, well, thank you again. I really appreciated being able to speak with you and to myself. Okay. You're welcome.